Are you worried about climate change? Who isn't? This is Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock, and we'll be talking with Dr. Spencer Wirt about climate fear. Dr. Spencer Wirt is director for the Center for History of Physics at the American Institute of Physics in College Park, Maryland. He has a PhD in physics and astrophysics. And Dr. Wirt, I first read your 1988 book, Nuclear Fear, A History of Images. I wanted to understand how we dealt with the ultimate threat of nuclear war, both for myself and as a society. And now we find a similar problem with climate change, and you've written a book about the scientific discovery of global warming, published by Harvard University Press in 2003. Well, we have a lot to cover, but I'd like to begin by asking, why did you change course early in your life, moving from pure physics to re-educate yourself as a historian?
Well, it was just more interesting to me. The route I was on would have led me into NASA, and already at that time one could see that NASA wasn't going to be a very good place to work. In fact, the telescope I would have worked on wouldn't have flown for many, many years. So it was either retool myself in physics or go into something that I actually found I enjoyed doing more, which was reading and writing history. And it worked out. It turned out that it was the right career choice for me.
I think so. Well, now, nuclear fear has never left us. It seems to have morphed from the Cold War to terrorism. Mm-hmm. People are worried a city might suddenly blow up under us.
You bet. There's a couple of three shows on American television right now which have featured nuclear explosions.
Really?
Well, there's Jericho, 24, and Heroes, all built around nuclear explosions.
Well, if I understand your work correctly, you concluded we deal with this kind of grand fear using very old images or archetypes. Could you explain that for us?
Yeah, it's one of the big surprises to me when I started to look into it was how pervasive and how old nuclear imagery is. It predates 1945. It even predates the discovery of radioactivity. People were talking about kinds of mystical rays and strange poisons and so on, and this just got picked up and moved over into radioactivity when it came along. People were talking about mad scientists and mutant monsters, Frankensteins and so forth, and that all just fitted so neatly into what actually can happen, since radiation actually can cause mutants and so on. And all kinds of end-of-the-world things were also brought up in all of these magical ideas of transformation and apocalypse, and those too fitted neatly into ideas about the actual facts. Of course, they got exaggerated. For example, radioactivity doesn't really make things grow bigger. If anything, it'll stunt your growth. And nuclear weapons, even at their worst, won't cause a complete extinction of all life on Earth. But these were old myths that got appropriated and fit well enough with nuclear energy so that they just became all part of one giant complex of images, a unique complex of images. There's nothing in modern culture so powerful and so linked to all kinds of old imagery as nuclear energy.
And some of this proceeds on a non-rational level, you feel?
Oh, of course. All of these things have non-rational things. In fact, the image of the monster and the mad scientist is important precisely because it has deep psychological resonances. The mad scientist can trace back to witches and shamans and all kinds of creatures who represent, if you will, the dark side of ourselves. And the monster likewise represents side of ourselves, perhaps, if you will, the infantile destructiveness that loves to knock down the blocks. And all this is carried along in the images that have become attached to nuclear energy, and which, by the way, now tend to get associated and hooked onto the terrorist and the nasty dictator. These things don't go away. They just transmute in the image of the enemy, the other, the one who is different from us, takes new forms, but underneath it's the same.
I wonder what sort of archetypes we're going to use to explain global warming to ourselves.
Well, I naturally was concerned about that because when I started work on the history of the science of global warming, I was attentive to images, and I was rather surprised to find that the imagery there is much less extensive and much weaker. I thought, gee, I'd find another big complex of images. It just wasn't there. The nuclear imagery is actually quite unique in its scope and power. And when you get to images of global warming, one of the problems, and some cultural critics have pointed this out, is one of the problems is that there isn't any big fearful thing that you can sort of catch onto. And when you look how people have tried to show global warming in editorial cartoons or in documentaries and so on, They show storms, they show floods, they show droughts. Well, this is just weather imagery. We're familiar with weather imagery. It doesn't carry the kind of kick that an image of a city in ruins would carry, or that of a giant raging green monster with five eyes. You see a picture of a tornado, and it doesn't necessarily carry the kind of emotional freight that you get out of nuclear war. And this is a problem because global warming is just as dangerous a threat, if you will, to our security and to our economy as nuclear weapons ever were.
But we're having trouble picturing it, perhaps.
Yes, you can't really picture it. You know, you can have a movie that shows a new ice age, and that's actually kind of ridiculous because that doesn't really happen. Or you can have movies that show cities that are drowned and underwater, and that might happen, but not for 300 or 400 years. It's not like the whole cities are going to become flooded within the next 10 or 20 years. Again, different from the images of bombed cities in a nuclear war, which could happen, you know, next week. So it's one of these slow problems. And again, many people have pointed this out, that the attention span of the public and of politicians, of corporations and everything might be 5 or 10 years. And 5 or 10 years from now, things are going to be only a little different from the way they are now in terms of the weather. And try to take steps now for something that is going to become really serious in maybe 50 years' time is difficult. And then there's the additional problem that when people first started warning about it, of course, it was 100 years off. You know, they first started warning about it in the 1970s, something that would happen in the 21st century. It was very far off. So people have gotten used to the warnings, and it doesn't quite occur to them that the time that people warned about in the 1970s as being 100 years off is now only maybe 60 years off. And you know, when they warn about it 20 years from now, then it'll be that much closer.
Well, as you know, the people over at the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists have moved the doomsday clock ahead 2 minutes, making it 5 minutes before midnight for the human race. But this year, they added global warming to the nuclear threat. And I wanted to start with the nuclear part. George Bush has proposed a renaissance of the nuclear bomb-making industry by creating a new generation of nuclear weapons. What do you make of that?
Well, what is one to make of that? In the first place, now that there's a Democratic Congress, it doesn't seem too likely to come off. In the second place, I don't think that that's a particularly important development. If you change in your weapons for new ones, it's not very good in terms of encouraging people to give up their weapons. But I don't think that this is the most important thing to concentrate on when you're talking about proliferation. There are many more profound problems on how to prevent proliferation, and primarily have to do with giving countries security. A nation that feels secure, or even halfway secure, isn't going to make nuclear weapons because, as has generally been recognized, holding nuclear weapons in a world where some people already have them adds to insecurity. The main reason why we don't have many more nuclear-armed nations now is because of their impracticality in that sense. You know, back in 1945, if somebody asked how many nations in the year 2007 will have nuclear weapons, people would have guess 30, 40, 50, and it's actually much less than that. And that's because nations that started to build them realized, hey, if we build them, we're actually going to put ourselves in greater danger. So it's only countries that feel themselves, or I should say, it's only regimes that feel themselves acutely threatened that are going to go the proliferation route. And therefore, our main job is to not make them feel threatened. Now, building nuclear weapons, particularly new types, such as the ones that were proposed a while back, and that is nuclear weapons that were explicitly designed to bomb the Iranian nuclear weapons producing facility, that is clearly something that would be seen as something making the other country insecure and will actually lead them to be more likely to do it. That fortunately seems to have been stopped.
All right.
There's
well,
a long rant. I don't know how much you want to know. You're going to cut this, I trust.
Well, actually, I appreciated your opinions there very much. I do want to return back to the way we handle this psychologically, if we can. In your book, Nuclear Fear, and I think that's still necessary reading. I really do.
I'm coming out with a new edition in a couple of years, by the way.
Really?
Yeah,
okay.
I've got a contract sometime next year, probably.
Okay. Well, you list four main psychological mechanisms that people used to cope with that threat, and they were, if I may, cognitive dissonance, denial, habituation and learned helplessness. And I realize that was a while ago, but if we could briefly talk about these, because I think they apply beautifully to the problems of climate change as well. So what is cognitive dissonance?
Well, cognitive dissonance, the easiest way to put it is I believe A, I see this fact B, which doesn't fit with A, therefore B must be untrue. I believe that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction and nobody comes up with them. Well, there must be something wrong with the inspectors. They just can't find them. Cognitive dissonance is when two things that you believe fight one another, and therefore you put down the one that fits worst with what you already believe.
So if we had the case of a preacher who was very against homosexuality but then turned out to have a homosexual affair, is that cognitive dissonance?
Well, that goes even deeper than that. I would say that if let me take a more immediate example. If I believe very strongly that government regulation is always bad and that the government must never regulate industry, then global warming, which can only be solved by government regulation, must be untrue. There can't be real climate change, because if there were, then I'd have to believe in government regulation, which I definitely disbelieve in. That's an example of cognitive dissonance, a real-world example.
Well, what about if I think I'm fairly green and I'm worried about global warming, but I really want that big SUV with a V8 engine?
Yeah, that can certainly cause cognitive dissonance, although it's more likely simply to cause denial, which is a refusal even to put the two ideas together. You keep one idea over here, and you just say, well, no, that's, you know, well, I shouldn't say that's denial. But, you know, these mechanisms all overlap a bit. And I must say, since I wrote the book, there has been some new psychology that's come along that I think takes us a bit beyond the state of psychology at the time that I wrote the book, which, after all, was 20 years ago. We know now from, we can do brain scans, and we can see how the brain lights up in different regions when something happens to it. And we know that the brain is actually made up of a whole set of different mechanisms. There isn't any one unified way of thinking. There's a part of the brain that's thinking this way, and there's another part of the brain that's trying to put the two together with what it perceives. And then deep down in the part of the, there's a part of the brain which records emotional circumstances. So if I see, for example, if I'm a young person, I see a horrible picture of people being mangled and burned up, and I'm told that this has to do with the nuclear weapon, this may make such a deep impression on me that it affects my thinking from then on. And every time the rest of my life that somebody says nuclear weapon, something deep in my brain will go ping and remember that fear that I felt when I saw those mangled bodies. This is similar to the mechanism of post-traumatic stress disorder and so on. So we know that there are these different parts of the brain all going around together with one another. And although this is less well understood, sometimes they can get disconnected. So sometimes the part of the brain that is thinking one thing, just the connection fails with the part of the brain that is thinking the other thing. Now, I think these are the kind of mechanisms that lead us to understand better things like denial and cognitive dissonance in an almost physical way. And these are the things that happen when we try to deal, even rationally, with something that involves so many things as global warming. As you say, it may involve our comfort with what kind of SUV we want to buy, which in turn ties in with some kind of social consciousness, and may involve visions we have of floods. The flooding caused by Hurricane Katrina, for example, may have embedded some emotional things in our mind. And the way these connect up with one another is not simple and not necessarily consistent.
Well, the media is opening up a deluge of stories about global warming, and I worry about something you did mention earlier, the habituation, that we'll just go numb and take climate disaster for granted. Do you think that's a possibility?
Oh, yeah. Well, as I say, I think our grasp of global warming as a threat already is a problem, because people, even before they ever heard of global warming, were habituated to pictures of floods and droughts and storms and so on. They'd seen it so many times that unless it had been a really traumatic image, as perhaps some of the images of flooded New Orleans or whatever might be, then it fails to make an impact and fails to connect up in particular with anything meaningful. It just becomes sort of a floods just sort of floating out there. Floods. I've known about floods since I heard about Noah. It doesn't connect up and become meaningful.
We're speaking with the historian physicist Dr. Spencer Wirt. Going back to your own development, how did a specialist in nuclear physics come to write a book about the early science of global warming?
Well, actually, I was concerned about it quite early on. I was originally doing history of nuclear physics just as a science and became somewhat interested then in the images of it, because you can't study the nuclear physicists without seeing how pervaded they were with nuclear imagery. I mean, they knew about the bomb as an idea before the First World War, long before anybody knew how to build it, so that the imagery clearly had an important driving force in the science. So as I studied this, I became interested in all the different implications of nuclear weapons and nuclear energy. And one of the things that people recognize, and this was already in the 1970s, is that one reason for building nuclear reactors was that we might need them in case of global warming. Now, nobody knew back then whether global warming was real or not, but they knew enough to know that it was a risk. So one reason that I studied nuclear images was in order to help people understand what was good and bad about reactors. And one of the things that's good about them is that they don't emit carbon dioxide. And this was already recognized back in the 1970s. Then when I finished Nuclear Fear, writing my book Nuclear Fear, I wasn't going to write any more on nuclear energy. And this is something that's happened to a lot of people who studied things. You can only look at so many movies and read so many books about people being wiped out and dying horrible deaths and so on. And then you just don't want to study it anymore. You're tired of having nightmares about it, so you go and study something else. Well, global warming was beginning to become more clear as a potential problem, so then I decided, okay, well, I'll go and study the scientific history of global warming and the imagery. Although, as I said, there turned out to be a lot more scientific study to look into than there was imagery.
Right. You almost have to be a scientist of scientists to write that book. There's so many different fields that we're working on it.
Yeah, well, actually, as a historian, this is one of the things that attracted me to it. I think I really did the study to show how science works in one of these cases where you don't just kind of sit down, have a theory, do an experiment, then that confirms your theory, and you do another theory, another experiment. Geophysics is very different from that. It's a different kind of science. And I thought it would be interesting and illuminating to study how you can discover something when no single person can discover it. It can only be discovered by a community of hundreds, thousands of people, who in fact may not even know about each other's work until, 10 years later you hear, oh, somebody over there discovered something that's relevant to my work. And in fact, I found it very difficult to show this in a book, these kind of interactions. The book that I did is not really the full history. And the full history I put on a website. It's all called The Discovery of Global Warming. It's www.aip, that's for American Institute of Physics, aip.org/history/climate, or you can just Google Discovery of Global Warming. And what I did there was I put up 20 different essays, one on solar energy, one on ice age cycles, one on the biosphere, one on carbon dioxide, one on other gases, and hyperlinked them together to show how a scientific result that was discovered at one point might have some influence on a scientific result found at some other point. So there's 20 essays, 30 essays actually, if you include the politics and the government and so on, because all this stuff had to be funded, with about 1,000 different hyperlinks connecting the different parts together. And that's the true image of how the science is done.
Well, it's a really new approach, because you've both published the book, which is mercifully short, and I thought pretty clear about the different scientific problems. And then you have this huge online website, a kind of database of your research. You call it a hypertext history. And you even encourage people to download it and burn it on a CD-ROM for their own use. What are you working on now?
Well, I'm going back to Nuclear Fear. I'm keeping the website updated, by the way. I do an annual update because the science and the politics are changing with tremendous rapidity. But I found it interesting that you had called me. You're the second person this week who is interviewing my Nuclear Fear. I just read on the web another person sort of who studied nuclear stuff back in the 1980s was being interviewed. It's clear that there's a revival of concern about nuclear imagery. As I say, there's television shows on it and so on. So I'm going to do a new edition of my book, which will, in the first place, is going to be shorter than the original book, because people don't like to read so much nowadays. And then it'll cover the changes in the last 20 years, the shift from concern about giant wars to concern about terrorists and dictators and all that sort of thing. There's been some profound changes in nuclear imagery, of course.
And do you think, personally, that humans will survive knowing these ultimate secrets of the universe?
Oh, sure. Human beings are very hard to wipe out. I even think civilization will survive, although we'll probably kill a lot of ourselves off along the way, as we always have done.
And what about climate change? The Gaia scientist James Lovelock thinks we've already damaged the climate, and he sees the remnants of humanity living near the Arctic Sea trying to escape the heat. But perhaps that's one of your survival myths that in your books.
Yes, exactly right. I was very surprised that a good scientist like Lovelock would come out with this, because there's essentially no climate scientist who would agree with that scenario, on the assumption that things will, when things get bad enough, we'll start doing something about it. If we burn all the coal that we can get at, then we could certainly cause an incredible amount of damage to the climate system. But I think most of us assume that as things start to get really bad, we'll stop burning the coal before we put it all up into the atmosphere. I think it's very positive development that people are taking this seriously. When you consider that it's just something that comes out of scientists' computer models and isn't going to happen for 50 years, it's a new development in the history of the human race that people are taking this kind of future thing very, very seriously. I think that's a very positive and optimistic development.
Well, good. A good place to end. We've been talking with Dr. Spencer Wart, a history of both physics and climate change, and thanks a lot for taking the time to share your work with us.
My pleasure entirely.
This is EcoShock Radio. All environment, all the time. Get more info on the web at ecoshock.org.